This is Julia Gottlieb here with Rebecca Wolf on June 17th, 2019, at Rebecca's house in Hudson, New York. We're here together as a part of an oral history project, collecting an archive of voices and stories of the people who live here. I just met Rebecca tonight through this project. Rebecca, can I have you introduce yourself?
Mm-hmm. I'm Rebecca Wolf. I live in Hudson, and I'm an editor and a writer, and I've been living in Hudson since 2005, off and on, but mostly on. And I feel very much at home here. This is, I think, the longest place that I've lived, other than my childhood home growing up. Yeah. And I could say lots of different things about myself. I can just talk on and on about myself. Let's see. Currently running for first ward alderman in Hudson, which I decided to do after I moved back to Hudson from living across the river in Greene County. I moved back here in 2012, and I bought this house that we're sitting in right now. And I became a landlord because there's a apartment. Actually, this apartment that we're sitting in was, I had tenants who had been my neighbors. They became my tenants. And pretty much at that time, I just decided, if I was gonna essentially be part of the onrushing wave of gentrification happening in Hudson, that I had to figure out a way to do it in a way that didn't make me feel really terrible about myself, essentially. So at that time, I decided to, I had all sorts of ideas, including trying to form a group of landlords who weren't going to be rent gouging, basically. I haven't done that yet, but I started looking into the issue of short-term rentals in Hudson and started trying to poke at the government, basically, to get some legislation passed. And long story short, I haven't gotten any legislation passed yet, but it's almost going to pass, hopefully. And it's being drafted right now. But anyway, all of those experiences led me to just decide to go ahead and run for office. So, yeah, and the election is in a week, basically.
Could you tell me a little bit about where you were before you came to Hudson?
Yes. Immediately before I came to Hudson, I was, I want to explain that I lived in Athens for a while. So I moved to Hudson in 2005, and then in 2007, I moved across the river to Athens, which is in Greene County. And I lived there until about 2012. And yeah, Athens was a very interesting place to live. Really tiny, a village, almost a hamlet, really. But and it's right on the Hudson River. Very beautiful. Very isolated feeling, but not in a bad way. And can I tell him to be quiet?
Hey, Asher, honey?
Yes, Mom?
Can you try not to bang stuff around just because
Sorry.
Thank
sorry.
You.
So I raised children there. We had two children who are now teenagers, and they were little there, and so we were sending them to the school, and it was kind of a tough place to live in a way because it's so small and very much like a old style, a real community in a sense, really not accustomed to people moving there from other places, and so there wasn't a sense of like, oh great, you're new, let's make you feel welcome. It was more like, hi, how are you? And then that's it. I think there was, I wouldn't go so far as to say that there was like suspicion of new people, but it was more just like, we don't need you, you know? So that was interesting. But essentially the place like made up for that by being really beautiful and easy to spend time there. Just like,
so. This milk is super expired.
Hey, sweetie, I'm sorry, I can't really talk to you right now.
Oh, okay, yeah, it's recorded, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
but it should be good, actually.
It's expired.
Jesus Christ. Oh, my God. So, we lived there and kind of had, like, you know, one group of friends that we knew and often came over to Hudson for everything else that we needed. Like, my kids were in daycare in Hudson, and doctors were in Hudson and things like that. So it was still sort of like living in Hudson. And I missed Hudson while I was there. I always kind of missed the feeling of being here. Yeah.
And can you tell me about where you grew up and how that's different from how your kids have grown up, or same?
Ooh, yeah. I grew up in Manhattan. I grew up in the 1970s in Manhattan. So, like, a really different feeling environment in the city from what it is now. And yeah, I grew up, you know, in a very, like, really urban experience of, you know, taking public transportation all over the place and just being very, like, anonymous, actually. I think that was maybe the signature experience of my life growing up, is the ability to, like, not know anybody that you're walking around with, really, because in New York City, like, even if you're, you know, pretty ensconced in your neighborhood, you're often just surrounded by, like, only strangers, you know? So that was, like, a comfortable thing for me. And when I went to, like, college, I went to a very tiny little liberal arts college at first, and I think that was the first really shocking experience I had of being, like, there was no opportunity to be anonymous. You know, everywhere you went, there was, like, people you had to deal with, and I found that very challenging. And, you know, growing up in New York City, like, it's funny, I think that probably many people would say something about, like, the cultural experiences available to you, blah, 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 but my family wasn't really participating much in that. We were more just, like, just kind of, I don't know, it was maybe a little bit insular. But, so, I mean, for my kids, it's been, yeah, kind of a quizzical, hilarious thing that they're growing up in these, like, really small environments. We were in Athens, which is, you know, tiny, and then they've been here, but then also their dad lives in Germantown, which is close to Hudson, but Germantown is, like, really tiny as well, and they live, like, in the country, basically, in there. So they have, like, Hudson is the city, for them, and is increasingly a place where they don't know everybody they see. Although when we first were living here, it was much more like folksy, kind of like you could kind of imagine, especially on the, like, in the winter and on weekdays, you would pretty much know everybody, or know a lot of people. So yeah, they're having, like, a whole breadth of different experiences, because also my family is still in the city, so we go there sometimes, and You're getting like a million different flavors of life, which is pretty cool. Yeah. And I mean, school is really different here for them. And like, I went to some pretty groovy, progressive educational environments, and they definitely are not. Like, so that's been quite challenging for me. I find it a little bit depressing how just they're like totally kind of, I don't know, pretty standard educational experience that they're having. And it's kind of funny because like when we were living in Athens, we were trying to create a school and had all these ideas about like basically a super progressive environment for them to learn in, and none of that panned out for us. So they're just like taking the standardized tests and just relating to some pretty basic curriculum, but they seem to be okay, which I guess is the main lesson or something. They're pretty okay. They don't actually know what they're missing, which bums me out. But I don't know. I hope as adults they'll encounter what the other stuff or something.
What are some of the things that you think they're missing out on?
I think they're missing out on being allowed to like really question, really be shown how to question like what they're being taught. You know, like I think a lot of times you know, what kids, some kids need to be encouraged to like interrogate something, you know, and my kids tend to be, well, one of them tends to be pretty oriented that way, and the other tends to be like more quiescent about just her experience with what she's told to do, you know. Yeah, I just wish there was like a little bit more agency in the whole process for them. I think there are like some attempts to give them that in the school, but and they totally do get that in their home environments a lot. Plus also it may be that like at this point with the way they're imbibing all their information and media, it's like built into it is that they're kind of shown how to like basically not trust it or something. So critical thinking maybe comes more that way. Seems like, I don't know, I'm wondering, you as a younger person, you might know more about that, but it seems like, I mean, there's just so much that people are being asked to like navigate and figure out where they stand in relation to so many different things. So I guess I'm feeling like these guys, I can tell that they like definitely have the capacity to, I think they have the capacity to question stuff pretty easily. But I don't think that's coming necessarily through their school experience. Maybe that's not where it has to come from. I don't know. Yeah.
Can you talk about some of the places where you feel like you learned those skills, those critical thinking? You talked about your progressive educational upbringing.
Right. I mean, the school that I went to for grade school was pretty radical, really. It was a free school. And so we were given like a lot of leeway in how we chose to spend our time during the day. And my brother and I both went to this same school from kindergarten through sixth grade. So it was like pretty much our full, you know, inculcation, I want to say, in what, like, who we were, basically. Like, we were made to feel as though we were, like, fully, I don't want to say in charge, because that's not how I felt at the time. Or maybe I did. I don't know. Like, I think that, yeah, we basically felt like we were, it wasn't a question of, like, are you as, do you have as much power as a grown-up or something like that? It was really just like, you are you. You know, you're like, you are totally yourself. And I mean, it's occurred to me that there might be like a little bit too much agency in that as well, because, and I've thought about this quite a bit, like the whole concept of, you know, learning like healthy boundaries. I don't think we got that. I think we got, maybe a sense that we were limitless and that we didn't necessarily have to like bounce up against like limitations, which is, I don't know if that, like, that sounds pretty kind of cool, really, in a way. I mean, I think there's, I guess it's like not black or white. It was partially really amazing and then also has some drawbacks. So yeah. And I mean, educationally, it's been funny because, like my daughter, for example, is very she's very competitive. She has like this really kind of just native sense of wanting to like do as well as her friends, or like compete with them. She actually just literally wants to compete with them, which is totally foreign to me. And and I honestly don't know whether that's like healthy or not to have that, or like it's just what she has. So so I, like, looking back at my own, I was like really basically not at all interested in competing, and I kind of shrunk from those sorts of situations. So I don't know. Yeah, I'm not answering your question very much. But I think just generally we had the sense of like, that what we were thinking about or what we wanted to do with ourselves and our time was totally valid, just whatever it was. And like, I did a lot of just reading, basically. And my brother did a lot of reading too. That's what I think, that's how we like got through our childhoods. So it's weird for me that children don't read now. It's a strange development in life that I'm not totally comfortable with at all. Yeah. So like, actually right now I'm having this conflict with my daughters. Well, a conflict that has gone on the whole time is like, there's a real tendency, I'm sure you're probably aware of it, like children get very, very scheduled, and there's always like something that they're doing, and they're kind of expected to participate in like many different after school or during school, and be like, so my daughter's like very willing to go and do that. And I think, I mean, she says that she really feels that that's how she feels good, is if she's like really busy and doing a lot of different things. Like, basically she wants structure. And I all along have just been like, but wait a minute, you're totally over, like, you have no time to just kind of have your own thoughts or like be bored. I mean, I read early on, like, I got a lot of validation, I think, as a parent, on the idea that like it's good for a child to be bored. You know, being bored doesn't, I mean, I honestly don't ever in my entire life remember thinking like, I'm bored. I just like never felt, or I might have had like the experience of feeling restless and wanting to switch to do something different from what I was doing, but like then I could basically do that. And so I've been, yeah, like, so this summer my daughter really wants to go to camp, and I'm like, hey, what if you just like had some time to just do whatever, and also read, like, you know, just kind of have like free time. And I think it's really terrifying for her, the idea of just having free time, which it really blows my mind, honestly. It seems kind of sad. Like, it's not like she won't have friends around. There are friends, and there's things that are gonna happen. But, yeah. So that's kind of where I'm at right now.
You mentioned that you kind of encountered some challenges when you went to your small liberal arts college for the first time. Can you talk more about that?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was a lot going on for me at the time, which I'm totally willing to talk about. It's a little bit intense, possibly outside the scope of the archive. I don't know. But I'm actually writing about it currently, so I feel like, okay, it's hopefully at some point going to be public. So right before I was going to college, so I was around 16, 17, I was doing a lot of hallucinogenic drugs. And I had a pretty, like, pretty major experience, like negative experience with some hallucinogenic drugs. And basically sustained a little bit of an injury. Like a, I don't know what to call it, like a spiritual slash social slash emotional and psychological and neurological, probably, injury from it. And so I was kind of recovering from it when I went to college. And it didn't turn out to be a good idea for me to go to college. And so I got to this, like, really intensely high-pressure environment of just there were 600 students at this school. And so I was trying to just, like, deal with myself. I mean, I was basically experiencing really intense anxiety and kind of a changed reality. Like, I was a little bit post-traumatic. and I was trying to, like, be a student for almost sort of for the first time, because I was really not engaged in studies in high school, and I was pretty much only, like, just kind of doing my social life in high school. That's pretty much what I did. And so it was a funny combination, because I was, like, newly introspective, because I had this kind of psychedelic, like, mind-bending and opening experience. So I was very introspective and like, pretty engaged with what I was reading and thinking about, but engaged with it also in a, like, a really somewhat convoluted way. So I went just kind of into this rabbit hole of, like, self-involvement that was very, like, hard to get out of. And I stayed in school there for, like, a year and a half, and I really tried. I mean, I was doing, you know, I did my classes, wrote papers, and also I should say that I've always been, like, pretty good at concealing what's going on with me. So I was totally functional in a lot of ways, and I had friends, and I was, like, doing things, you know, managing it. But a couple things about the environment were pretty bad for me, including this sort of hyper-privileged environment that I was in, which I was just trying to talk about this with my son earlier today, which conversation didn't go very well. But, like, I think I got a kind of a weird feeling of, like, of just alienation from that whole aspect of it. Like, there were a lot of, it was a college that basically a lot of really, really pretty privileged people attend. And
I'm letting my cat out. Meow.
So there I was, and I was really not, I just hadn't had to think about these things much, and I didn't have a lot of, like, support to talk about it or think about it or deal with it, and so I just felt very uncomfortable, basically. And so, in the middle of my second year, I just decided not to go back. And I just decided to stay where I was, which was living in Boston. And I just, like, got a job in an apartment and just stayed there and just worked and tried to, like, figure out how to be comfortable in the world, which I didn't really do a very good job of for a while. But I should mention I write poetry. So, you know, whatever aspects of, like, making art can come out of a sense of alienation from that worked out okay for me, and I wrote a lot and just sort of, like, yeah, really tried to be well, I guess you could say now that would be the term, tried to access some wellness, and yeah. And then eventually went back to school and did okay. I went back to, like, a completely different environment. I didn't go back to that same college. I went to a state school and just, like, I mean, I always, even at that time, I thought of it as, like, I was basically seeking anonymity. You know, so I didn't live on campus. I just, like, lived in a nearby town and just had an apartment and went to school and was almost like a commuter type of situation. Yeah. Hmm.
Could you tell me about writing poetry? How you came to that?
Yes. yeah, I started writing poetry when I was a teenager. I started writing, like, fiction when I was really young, like 12, 13 kind of thing. And so then, yeah, when I was about 15, I think, I wrote poems. And it was a funny thing. Like, I mean, I came from a family of sort of literary people. Like, on both sides of my family, one of my grandparents was an editor of, like, a magazine and a newspaper, and my father had been a writer and an editor, a more journalistic type. So I was, you know, really, and my parents were both very conscious of language and how you use it, and, like, even now it's funny, when I'm with them, I can really hear, like, how their language is so precise, and they're very kind of, you know, just hyper aware of the word choice and how you express something. And so I think that, you know, they say poetry is emotion recollected in tranquility, I believe is what they say. And I've been thinking about that a little bit lately. Like, I think for me, it's always been about, trying to express, like, a particular event that takes place only in language, but that is, like, colored by my, you know, particular experience, whatever that might be, or just, like, the vibe. I'm, like, definitely influenced by whatever the vibe is. And so, yeah, so I started writing poems at that time, and I've also been thinking lately about how I think a lot of my teenage poems were, like, pretty socially conscious, which is funny because then later I didn't write anything real, like, you know, like as a teenager, I think I was really observing, I don't know, stuff going on around me in the streets, basically, that I, where I was growing up, like homeless people, bums, bag ladies, you know, all sorts of stuff like that, and other stuff too, but that's what I'm remembering currently. And I guess I was mostly just like aware of, again, like my discomfort. And so, you know, trying to like register something that I really didn't know much about. Like, I definitely didn't have any advanced ideas politically or socially. I just was like, there's a guy sleeping in a doorway. Like, so, and that's, it's funny, that's been a thread, is just kind of like registering, like imbalances or something. But yeah, so that was like my early writing. And then I just kind of continued it. Like, I never really have stopped. And so by the time I was going to college, I knew that, like, I really wanted to be a poet, whatever that meant. And, so that's one of the reasons I went to the tiny little liberal arts college, is that it seemed like it would be one of the places where I would be able to just, like, focus on poetry. Which is, you know, at the time, like, that's, I don't know, it's become actually really strangely common now for people to want to study creative writing. But at the time, so this was like the mid 80s, I graduated from high school in 85, and it was really unheard of. Like, nobody as an undergraduate would study creative writing, and even as a graduate student there were very few programs for something like that. So it's been a really strange thing to watch as it like morphs into an industry and a, like, a whole, I don't know, weird galaxy of professional opportunities that people have, I guess, which I find really strange. But at the time, it was just like, I was really in such a bubble, and I was like, that's what I do, and that's what I'm gonna do. And I really had no thought about, like, what am I going to do for a living? So that was a very privileged experience. Like, I went to college just sort of like, I write poetry and that's what I'm going to do. But I think the flip side of that, I've been, again, like, really trying to figure this out. I think I always was sort of like, wow, I used to kind of internally chastise my parents for allowing me to do that without really considering it. And then I realized, like, well, yeah, they probably had some assumptions about what I might do with that. But then also I balanced that by, like, just basically being, you know, pretty open to any kind of employment. Like, I just was always working and doing jobs, and they had nothing to do with poetry, and that seemed okay too. Yeah.
Can you tell me about when you think you started becoming socially conscious? You mentioned that you kind of thought it was funny that you noticed that when you were a kid, but...
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that I think I've always been extremely, almost like hyper alert to class issues. And in some kind of strange ways though, like, partially arising out of like just the kind of, I don't know, weird experiences that I've had around privilege. Maybe not that weird, I don't know, just, growing up sort of privileged adjacent, I would call it, like, privilege adjacent. And growing up in New York City, like, one of the first, poems that I remember writing when I was, like, maybe 15 or something, I just was telling my from this. It was called Eat the Rich. And it was about, like, observing. I went to somebody's house, a friend of my friend, and they went to a prep school. And the parents of this girl were leaving to go to a charity ball. And I was, like, really shocked and kind of, you know, horrified and also jealous or like, envious or covetous of, you know, like high class society life. And I think that actually came from, I used to like read a lot of Victorian novels, you know, so I was really aware of the, like the manners and graces of people who would be like rotating in society, whatever. So it was almost like a fictional attachment to that kind of concept. But then when faced with like actually what that would mean in terms of the world, like, well, if there are people who, you know, are actually like considered to be like essentially more rarefied, like if there's like a rarefied world of people who have access to experiences that no one else is supposed to have, like that's just fucked up. Like at a basic level. So I think that it's always been like a really weird, twisted thing for me because of exactly just that thing. It's like I see like total fucked upness and also something that, of course, everybody would want. Like everybody would want to feel like they could go to the party, you know, and eat the really delicious food and have wonderful like conversations with brilliant people. Everybody would want that. You know, so anyway, so for a long time I wrote, I mean, not like consistently and definitely not every single thing I've written at all, but it always has crept in at times in my poems, like a sort of a weird, almost like a ironic affect of, that kind of awareness of like, social, or just of rarefied experience in general. And I'll just say that I had this funny realization the other day where I was thinking about like arts nonprofits, which I've been involved with. And, you know, a lot of the times like arts nonprofits have to raise funds from wealthy people. That's one of the things that they do. And a lot of the times, you know, arts programming is about, like, has to show that at some level it's about bringing the arts to, like, underserved communities. And I was thinking, like, do underserved communities really need the arts? And I was like, no, actually, I think what it is like, everybody needs beauty. And, like, beauty does not necessarily correlate to the arts the way that we've been taught to think about it. Like, you don't have to have art to be able to relate to, like, the sublime in the world. So, anyway, that's my new mission, is to try to, like, unpack that somehow.
Where are some of the places or the people or anything that you feel like you've found beauty?
That's a great question, because, I mean, this one little example, like, I thought about this recently because I opened my sewing kit and was just picking out a spool of thread to sew a button on something, and like the color of the thread was so beautiful to me. And I remember that actually as a child, being so entranced by actually the color of like some candy wrappers that I had. I forget what kind of candy. I think it might have been little squares of chocolate or something, and they didn't have any words on them, the wrappers. They must have been like wrapped in something else. But they were shiny, metallic candy wrappers, and the colors just, like, I could have spent, like, all day with them, you know, and I, like, folded them, put them in something, and, like, they were, and my love of them was totally just the colors being so rich and, like, shiny and everything, and I was having kind of a, just a similar feeling about this, like, spool of thread, which was, like, a green color, and so, like, that's an example. And then, I mean, I do think, I mean, what comes to mind, I don't want to sound cheesy, but what comes to mind is, like, some of the experiences that I have when I'm actually trying to be interacting or, like, intervening in, like, government feels so good that I almost would call it an experience of, like, beauty. But that's, I mean, I don't know. I'm not sure that I feel like that's totally really what I'm talking about. It's just, like, that's one of the things lately that is feels, like, totally just great. But it might be a slightly different thing. I mean, beauty, yeah. I mean... Yeah, again, cheesy, but, like, growing flowers, like, some of them, like, just, not just looking at flowers, but actually growing flowers and, like, having them grow up and, like, be beautiful. It's, like, the whole experience is the beauty, I think.
Yeah. Can you tell me about some experiences of intervening in the government that you've had recently?
I mean, there's been a range of different things, like, I mean, one recent example is just trying to put together people who are potentially useful in, like, helping with some housing questions, or, like, for me, it's beautiful, truly, actually, like, I went to a picnic, and at the picnic, I happened to meet this woman who was, like, I was, like, what do you do? And she's, like, I work in affordable housing, I'm a, you know, consultant, blah, 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 and I was, like, oh, my God, well, I wonder if I could invite you to come and meet this other person that I know in Hudson, who is on the board of the housing authority, which runs the, like, low income housing project that we have. And so just, you know, so the three of us had lunch, and so there's, I mean, part of what it is like, you know, you get doing something like that, I get, like, a buzz from it. And I guess part of what I'm learning is, like, right, and then you have to, like, that buzz wears off. It's not just about, like, okay, cool, here we are, I'm doing this, this is good. It's like then you have to, like, you know, witness something not happening from that or not coming from it, and then, like, come back and still keep trying something else, or, like, or make another phone call to try to, like, keep making that happen, something like that. So yeah, I guess for me, I mean, I think we're all, like, anybody who's, you know, basically not really deluded right now is still experiencing the, like, slight despair of our political circumstances. And so that question of resilience, like, how do you bring that feeling back into yourself? I think for me, like, yeah, like, experiences of enacting resilience feel kind of beautiful too. It's like a refreshing, like, of the soul, you know. So yeah,
I'm interested in how you feel like your literary background has informed your political, the role you feel as a political person.
Yeah, it's funny. You know, I had an experience when I first started being a publisher, because I have a literary press and publish a literary journal that comes out twice a year. And early on publishing the journal, there was kind of like an attack on the journal, partially. So part of what the journal does is it publishes lots of different kinds of writing in the one place, and that was sort of like an ethics of representation, basically, and an ethics also of variousness, like the concept of difference, I guess, is in play there, like the idea that people need to be able to understand or relate to difference, even aesthetically. And like there was an attack that came, very like brutal and cruel attack from essentially like a Marxist perspective, sort of saying like, you know, lady, like some people make art the way they make it because they believe that like it's gonna change the world. And, like, so you can't just take that art out of its context and put it next to your other art that's just for beauty. Because you are then really, like, denaturing the political, like, ethic, or, you know, just... Well, and actually, and I mean, so that is one critique. Then the other critique was something about, essentially, like, that it's a neoliberal... position to kind of basically to think that there could be art that is not ideologically informed and grounded. So like the art that says it's all about beauty, like, is actually just about like selling stuff to people, which I definitely, like, I did not understand that argument at the time, and I've come to understand it, I think. But so my reaction at the time, which I still feel, basically I feel, is that I was like, you know, I could really see how that could be a valid argument, except that, like, unfortunately, it seems to be true that art has not been able to make major inroads in, like, political reality. You know, like, if you want to be a Marxist about it, like, actually take a look at what's going on in the material, like, world with, like, the relationship of art to I don't know, social equity or change. Like, it just hasn't really panned out. And so, essentially, because of that, I feel like it's not worth my time to kind of like worry about that as a problem of how I'm publishing this literary journal. Like, so it really is like a very pragmatic kind of response, I guess. And so what I was thinking about just today is like, wow, I see how that same way that I felt then has now morphed into a situation where I actually feel completely compelled to be, like, literally politically active. Almost because I'm an artist. Like, I actually think that artists have been, like, basically suckered as a entire class of being. You know, first we've been told to identify ourselves as an artist, and, like, and we've also been told to, like, spend a lot of money to become artists. And then to engage in, like, I don't know, creativity as a, like, consumer culture, pretty much. And then we've also effectively been removed from, like, I don't know, civic life somehow, it seems to me. And I have a way of, like, really making these totalizing statements and being super concrete and black and white, so I know I'm doing that right now. But I have a theory about why that's potentially okay, which is that I think that essentially it's called the blowhard theory, and it goes like this. It goes, there's always been people who just like are willing to just kind of be like, blah, 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 this is what's happening. And like, essentially it's like somebody has to kind of just like stick their neck out and say a bunch of stuff and hopefully, like, even though it's a little bit of a sledgehammer, it has enough like nuance to actually relate to the actual, just basically so that then people maybe will pull that apart and see where, what really holds true, something like that. Anyway, I do see this, like, wherever I'm looking, I see, you know, not enough people engaging with, like, the struggle, shall we say, and, like, a whole, you know, it's like, you know that Allen Ginsberg poem? It's like, I've seen the best minds of my generation mad in the streets, or whatever the rest of that line is, and I feel like you could rewrite that now. Like, I've seen the best minds of my generation, like, I don't know, doing marketing for a living because they're artists and they need to support their art, and they're gonna just do it however they can without, like, I don't know, kind of understanding, like, the negatives of all that. So, it's a confused argument, I think, but I don't know, I have to, I guess, I don't know, that seems to be a real problem. It's like a, I just feel like it's a big, really great, like, ploy to remove a lot of people from, I don't know, the, like, the, not that, like, politics is the real world, you know, but unfortunately, it's the thing that, like, runs the world. So, yeah. And it's funny, like, I went to Staples this morning to buy some stuff for my, like, job, and the cashier was this young man, and he was probably mixed race, like, I would guess, like, Puerto Rican and African American and other stuff. And so I said to him, like, are you excited about the election? And he was probably, like, I'm guessing, like, 25 or so, and he was like, oh, I'm not really, like, paying attention to that kind of thing. I don't really vote. I don't pay attention to that kind of thing. You know, I basically just try to do my own thing, and I'm an artist, he said, and he showed me a drawing that he'd done, which was cool, and I was like, it's gonna be my mission in life is to get artists to, like, at least know who's running for office and know who they want to vote for. I mean, yeah, that's funny.
What do you think generally about the art scene in Hudson?
I mean, I don't spend much time in it, really. When I first was living here, it had still kind of a flavor of, like, a small town art scene, like, a lot of regional or local artists, some galleries that were, like, connected to New York City or other cities, but mostly, like, pretty insular kind of stuff. And then, like, there was a big little explosion maybe 5 years ago where a couple of, like, New York City galleries opened here and people were like, whoa. And then there was the whole Marina Abramovic thing, which I'm guessing you've heard about. And currently, I mean, my concern about the art scene here in Hudson is kind of the same, really, as what I just said. Like, I basically feel like people who come to Hudson to be artists really need to figure out what's already going on here. Like, you can, I feel like anybody who thinks that they're an artist and is willing to just, like, move to a city and not basically deal with the fact that they're, like, displacing a bunch of people. I mean, and Hudson has, I'm sure you have talked about, like, you know, there's a real, I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to live here is that it's such a cool place, so unusual, because it has, like lots of different kinds of people, and that is kind of disappearing, and I kind of blame the art scene as like a hapless tool of gentrification. And so I wrote like a editor's note, which I'll show you, that's pretty much a call for artists to like not be colonialists and not just like get to Hudson and be like, oh, it's so cool, we can like get a studio and, you know, have a scene, without really like digging in and kind of being part of the community, which I have to be careful because it can make me sound like I think I'm like an absolute exemplary pillar of the community, which I'm not. But again, it's like sometimes you just have to call it like you see it, you know? So that's kind of what I'm doing, I guess. And I hope that, like, lots of people get to make art their whole lives. Because it's great.
Can you tell me about some more of your hopes for Hudson, or for you, for anyone?
I hope that there will be a redistribution of wealth such that we can all, within apparently 2 square miles of Hudson, not have to have boring jobs. Nobody should have to have a boring job. And everyone should get to spend part of their day gardening or otherwise enjoying the things that grow around us. And I hope that there'll be more like public gatherings than there are currently. I think that's like something that needs to be examined about Hudson and everywhere, is like, why have people forgotten how to just like be in public or something? And I hope that yeah, I mean, I have some really specific hopes, like political ones, but I feel like I'm ranting about that. I mean, all right, I hope that, like, more people who are landlords will decide to not raise the rents to exorbitant levels, which usually actually involves people deciding to live on less, you know, to, like, curb their expenses so that they don't have to, like, make as much money. Because a lot of people who, you know, own property are like, well, the taxes are so high, I have to charge exorbitant rents in order to, you know, make a profit, basically. And so that level, it's like, yeah, the enemy is profit. Profit's really bad, and so is private property. So. That's kind of where I'm at. I mean, it's quite amusing to me that I've gotten to this place where I'm like, actually, those are actually my convictions, is that like profit should not be illegal, but like really needs to be de-emphasized as a driving force of like why it's important to be alive, you know? I don't know who ever thought of that, but it's really misguided. And so, yeah.
And what about your kids? What are some of your hopes for them?
I mean, currently I'm hoping that they want to get really involved in some climate change activism. Because I think that in terms of that question of, like, how do people, like, maintain themselves as we go forward into this difficult time. I feel like that's going to be really important, is for people to know that they're plugged into a community and, you know, that's like pragmatically moving for solutions or change, or just not like going gently into that good night. You know, I feel like I've quoted 3 really like anthology poems in this. but yeah, so for my kids, I mean, in the immediate like terms, I want them to, I don't know, just enjoy themselves. That's what I want. Just like have time to enjoy their experiences and time to think about them, about stuff, and time to like explore. That's basically what I want for them. And yeah. Trying to think of one other thing that I want for them. There's nothing like practical that comes to mind that I want for them. I want them to take a shower every night because it's better for you.
Yeah.
Wash off all that dirt. That's what they need to do.
Is there anything else or anyone that you'd like to talk about that we haven't mentioned yet?
Kamal Johnson, who's running for mayor. I really am excited for the possibilities of like a very different team. Like, even, like, not even including if I'm part of the Common Council, which is what I'm running for, but I just think, like, it could be a real, just, like, kind of incredible, like, demonstration to the world. I mean, it's an interesting moment because Hudson is, like, on the world stage in this really weird way where there's so many people who want to make money here, and that, like, if we could get this whole other kind of team in place and just like make decisions for the city for different reasons than people expect, you know what I mean? Like, the expectations of the world are so status quo right now, and it's just like, yeah, things need to be shook up. So that would be my parting hope. Yeah, I just watched the Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez documentary last night. This one called Knockdown, I think, and it's thrilling. I recommend it highly. Yeah, just in terms of like paradigm shifts. Yeah.
Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah, it was really interesting to hear about everything that you think about the world, yeah.
Oh, good. Good. It gets a little bit boring inside my skull just thinking these thoughts to myself, so it's good to like...
Not boring to me at all, yeah. Thank you.
Cool. Thank you.